Hello, and thank you for downloading Witness from the BBC World Service. Today we're taking you back exactly 200 years to the only assassination of a British Prime Minister. Simon Watts reports on the death of Spencer Perceval.
It's the 11th of May 1812. A journalist called William Jerdon is heading to Parliament to cover a debate. On his way into the crowded lobby, he encounters the Prime Minister, Spencer Perceval.
On ascending the broad flight of steps, I perceived the Prime Minister immediately behind me, with his light and lithesome step. I saluted him and, of course, made way for him to go in. He did enter, and there was an instant noise. I saw a small, curling wreath of smoke rise above his head, as if the breath of a cigar. I saw him reel back against the ledge on the inside of the door. I heard him exclaim, "Oh God," or "Oh my God." Then I saw him totter forward and drop between the four pillars in the centre of the space, with a slight trace of blood issuing from his lips.
An assassin had shot Spencer Perceval in the chest at point-blank range. People rushed to try to save the Prime Minister's life, among them William Smith, MP.
I expected to see him make an effort to rise, but gazing at him for a few moments, I observed that he did not stir at all. We then took him in our arms to the office of the Speaker's secretary. There were scarcely any signs of life remaining. His eyes were still open, but he did not appear to know me, nor had he uttered the least articulate sound since he fell. A few convulsive sobs, which lasted 3 or 4 minutes, together with a scarcely perceptible pulse, were the only signs of life remaining. And when I felt his wrist for the last time, assisted by a surgeon, it appeared to me that he was totally dead.
Back in the lobby of Parliament, the killer, a businessman called John Bellingham, was sitting slumped in a corner.
Bellingham's neckcloth had been stripped off, his vest unbuttoned, and his chest laid bare. The discharged pistol was found beside him. Except for his frightful agitation, he was passive as a child. His countenance wore the hue of the grave, hollow and cadaverous. Huge drops of sweat ran down from his forehead like rain on the windowpane in a heavy storm. Someone said to Bellingham, "Mr. Perceval is dead. Villain, how could you destroy so good a man and make a family of 12 children orphans?" To which he almost mournfully replied, "I am sorry for it."
Bellingham was charged on the spot. He freely admitted killing the Prime Minister and calmly told the politicians why. The government, he explained, had denied him compensation for the years he'd spent in a jail in Russia over a business dispute. Andrew Linklater is the author of Why Spencer Perceval Had to Die.
He always described the murder not as a murder, but as an act of justice. And for him, it was really a matter of balancing the books. And he was, by training, an accountant. And the beginning of the debit column, if you like, against the government was when he tried to launch an expedition to trade in iron from Archangel in Russia. And it had gone wrong. He'd been stitched up. And he felt that the government should have done more to help him.
After leaving Russia, Bellingham appealed repeatedly to officials in London. Eventually, he dropped the matter and returned to Liverpool to try to rebuild his career. But in late 1811, his ambitions were thwarted again, this time by a clampdown on free trade. The Prime Minister had ordered the Navy to tighten Britain's economic blockade of Napoleonic France and crack down on mainly American-owned slave ships.
An extraordinary sort of economic recession has hit Britain. There's a trade war between Britain and the United States, and its effects are concentrated most of all in Liverpool, which is where Bellingham lives and where he works. And Bellingham himself was hit by this, and he also had a young baby son called Henry that he felt that he needed to provide for. And I think the idea of the compensation, the original compensation plea, came back, but it came back in a very different form. But now he had a very clear plan about how he was going to get the compensation.
And that involved lobbying every level until he got to the top, effectively.
It was. It is a perfectly clear sequence. It starts with the Prince Regent, then goes through the different departments of government, the executive, if you like. Then he prints a pamphlet at huge expense and circulates it to all the members of Parliament. And finally he goes to the judiciary. And when they, all of them, turn him down, he says, then I must proceed to the next course and bring this matter to court. And the way that he is going to take this matter to court is to kill the Prime Minister. Once the matter is brought to court and people heard his plea for compensation, then justice would be done to him.
And even his preparations for the assassination seem to have been incredibly methodical.
Precisely. I mean, the final approach to the judiciary is, I think, the end of March. He then goes to a very good gun maker in Snow Hill in London and purchases two pistols, each of them 9 inches long, and goes to sort of practice his shooting. And he had this dandyish attitude to clothing. And so he summoned a tailor and asked him to make a pocket in the inside of his beautiful chocolate surcoat. Every detail had been covered.
Bellingham was put on trial just 4 days after the assassination. He told the jury the whole story of his legal campaign, arguing that this was not murder because he bore the Prime Minister no personal malice.
Gentlemen, the refusal of justice was the sole cause of this fatal catastrophe. His Majesty's ministers have now to reflect upon their conduct for what has happened. The unfortunate lot fell upon Mr. Percival as the leading member of that administration. No man, I am sure, laments the calamitous event more than I do. I disclaim all personal or intentional malice against Mr. Percival.
Bellingham was convinced he'd be cleared. Instead, the jury took just 14 minutes to sentence him to be hanged.
The Times, May the 19th, 1812. Upon coming out, Bellingham looked up, apparently to see the state of the weather. He observed with great coolness, "Ah, it rains heavily." His voice never faltered, but just before he left the room to proceed to the place of execution, he stooped down his head and appeared to wipe off a tear. He ascended the scaffold with rather a light step, a cheerful countenance, and a confident, a calm, but not exulting air. While the cap was being put on and fastened, about a score of persons in the mob set up a loud and reiterated cry of, "God bless you! God bless you!" When Bellingham sunk, the most perfect and awful silence prevailed. Not even the slightest attempt at a huzzah or noise of any kind was made.
Recently, historians have wondered if Spencer Percival's assassination was more than the act of a lone killer. Andrew Linklater has discovered that Bellingham received large monthly payments which enabled him to stay in London to carry out his final plan. He thinks that money came from the killer's connections in Liverpool, who'd lost so much from government trade policy. It was in their interests to make sure the Prime Minister was assassinated.
It is clear there was a huge amount of anger there in the city. And if you have an unexplained crime, you say, who does it benefit? Cui bono? And it is perfectly clear that a lot of people did benefit from the murder of Spencer Percival. First of all, the illegal slave trade, which he had virtually halved, jumped up again. The moment the orders in council which kept the blockade in place were lifted, £1 million worth of goods left the warehouse in Liverpool to go to the United States and elsewhere. That is a lot of money, a lot of gain. Murder has been committed for less.
A fund to support Bellingham's widow was set up by Liverpool merchants. One of his distant relatives is now a Member of Parliament himself.
Simon Watts. For details of our complete range of downloads and our terms of use, go to bbc.com/worldservice.com/podcasts.